I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's tough being different, and some think small towns are even tougher, especially for those who stray from what most consider normal. But does the evidence bear that out? Today we speak with a University of Kansas researcher about her work with LGBTQ youth, and we'll find out firsthand what growing up trans is like in rural America. Then Senator Claire McCaskill has been busy lately hosting town halls throughout Missouri. She's up for re-election next year, and for a Democrat from a bright red state, it's going to be a tough fight. Later, Bill Brownlee presents this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. There was a big development in Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill's life yesterday. She got a major Republican opponent who now stands between her and a third election to the U.S. Senate. That Republican is Josh Hawley, and the McCaskill-Hawley race now shapes up as perhaps the marquee Senate race of 2018 anywhere in the country. Senator Claire McCaskill is conducting her 44th, 45th, and 46th town hall meetings in Missouri this week, and she joins us now. And Senator, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
You just got an opponent that you say Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has recruited to run against you. What do you make so far of Josh Hawley?
Well, you know, it's an interesting primary field. They have three declared candidates, and all three of them, I think, are different, and all three of them are claiming the conservative mantle. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it stacks up. Clearly, Josh is the establishment candidate. He is embraced by and recruited by Mitch McConnell and Jack Danforth and Kit Bond and kind of the establishment Republican Party in Missouri, which, you know, is a mixed bag these days, I think, in a Republican primary. So, time will tell. He's got a lot of questions to answer. I'm kind of relieved that he's finally publicly saying what his filing said months ago. He filed for the Senate in a Senate campaign committee with the federal government several months ago, but kept claiming publicly he was just exploring it. So now that he is making his rhetoric match his reality, it will be interesting to see if he answers questions, because so far he's been talking to a lot of insiders, but while I've been out talking to Missourians all across this state all year, and as you mentioned, now today will be my 46th town hall, he's not been answering very many questions.
And what do you want him to answer, Senator?
Well, he's refused to answer whether or not he would have voted for the repeal and replace plan that were voted on in the House.
And the Affordable Care Act, right?
Correct. He's refused to say where he stands on Dreamers. He has refused to talk about whether or not he supports a border wall all along our southern border and the costs associated with that. He has not, frankly, even said whether he's willing to vote for Mitch McConnell for leader. He refused to answer that question. And, you know, maybe I'm old-fashioned about this, but I kind of think it's important for the people of the state. You know, you're not always going to have a position that everybody agrees with, but it's important that you have the courage to state what your position is. And it looks like to me so far he's been trying to avoid that particular type of accountability.
You know, this race is already off to a hot start with your campaign calling Hawley a liar. An editorial in the Star today wondered if that's how negative it is on day one. What will the tone be like come next November? What do you say to that?
Well, I didn't think, I thought the editorial was, I thought it was just flat wrong. You know,
I should point out, I'm a member of the board. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I know you are. I just, you know, when I considered back earlier in my career running for attorney general, one of the things I took into account was the law that requires you to live in Jefferson City. That's the law. That's what the Missouri statutes require. It says shall. And the notion that he is trying to pretend that that law doesn't apply to him He is voting in Colombia. He's living in Colombia. Now, I get it that he may not agree with that law, but there's a process. If you don't agree with a law, you abide by it until that law is changed. And so the notion that that is somehow an unfair thing to point out, I think when the attorney general of the state thinks they're above the law, that's a fair thing to point out to Missourians. He knew what the law was when he ran. He's a fancy law school educated lawyer. He went to law school, I think, at Yale or Harvard or one of those. And him acting like he could ask somebody on his staff to write a letter that would somehow absolve him of the responsibility under the law that every attorney general in our state's history has abided by.
Senator Claire McCaskill is my guest. You're listening to Up to Date. You know, your town hall, Senator, you've just finished, as you just mentioned, your 46th of the year. You do these in mostly red parts of the state. Why do you do it that way?
You know, I know that most people who do town halls try to go to friendly territory because you don't know what you're going to encounter, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't control it. It isn't like, you know, some of these folks, you know, try to live their career through Facebook or think they can control the environments in which they answer questions. I really believe that I have an obligation to show up and show respect, even in the places in the state where I'm very unpopular. And so we focused on those places this year.
And you often ask audience members if they're for you or against you, right, when you begin a town hall. Sometimes people put their hands up and say they're against you, right?
Yeah, I ask for people who are positive they will never vote for me. And then of the people who raise their hands that are indicating they would never vote for me, I ask one of them to hold the basket and pick the questions. Because I do want to demonstrate to Missourians that I feel like I have an obligation to them to answer any question that anyone wants to ask of me. You know, I refuse to answer that question in a press conference because this is not what the press conference is about.
Right.
And not getting likes on Facebook. But a real open exchange. It's hard work. I'm not sure that anybody in Congress has done as many town halls as I have, either in the House or the Senate. I'm confident nobody has in the Senate. But it's the kind of work that I think people expect of folks who take the part of the phrase public servant seriously.
What's on the minds of Missourians these days, Senator, and what are they telling you? Because I know you just were in Independence yesterday. What did they say?
Well, it's interesting. There have been some themes that have emerged, and I would say the one thing that has emerged from all of these town halls is the palpable frustration people are having with how divided our country has become in Washington and how anxious too many members of Congress are to have a fight on ideology rather than finding a compromise on pragmatic problem solving. And I am gratified to hear that frustration, believe it or not, around the state, because, you know, I'm actually one of the few people, I think, left in Washington that is proud to call myself a moderate. I work across the aisle. I've gotten things done with my Republican colleagues this year, even. You don't hear a lot about what we're getting done, but I've passed some major pieces of legislation that will positively impact people's lives on a bipartisan basis. And I think people are longing for us to abandon the political food fights, especially over health care, and get together on a bipartisan way and find some compromise in the middle that improves their lives, especially in terms of their economics.
You know, President Trump, I got to ask you about him, obviously. He's been, you know, well, President Trump in recent days. Lots of controversy with Senator Bob Corker, a Republican colleague of yours. Lots of controversy with the vice president leaving the Colts game after the national anthem on Sunday. Lots of controversy pertaining to Twitter and his posts in recent days. What do you make of it all?
Well, I don't think, you know, first of all, he's the president and he was duly elected. And I am going to try to show respect for the office because I don't want to be a hypocrite and show respect for one president and not show respect for another president. On the other hand, I think he has, in many ways, with the way he has handled himself, demeaned the high stature that the president traditionally holds, not just in this country, but across the world. And I think he has wasted some opportunities to capture some enthusiasm in this country for economic benefits to the middle class. He's abandoned those in favor of some a shiny object that might capture a news cycle and divide us in terms of culture wars. I think that's unfortunate. And we need to focus on the working people that, frankly, gave Donald Trump his victory.
What about Senator Corker's
white working class voters?
What about Senator Corker's remarks in which he said the president's reckless remarks over a period of time threaten World War III, and that lots of senators privately believe this to be true? Does Corker have a point?
I believe he does have a point. I think a lot of us are frankly comforted by Secretary Mattis. I was thrilled to be able to vote for his confirmation. I know him. I know his leadership qualities.
Meaning Secretary Mattis might stand between the president and World War III.
I think Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson and John Kelly, who is his chief of staff, these are people who know that there are consequences to what the president says. And even though it's unfortunate that they're not always on the same page, I do think they are going to be in key positions to keep the president from doing anything impulsive that could have dire consequences in terms of our national
security. So what you're saying is pretty scary, that in the country today, that the president's top staff may have to shield this country from who knows what kind of horrors because of the impulsiveness of the president of the United States.
Yeah, I think that what I'm really saying is he clearly respects the generals. I think in the way he sees the world, he looks at everybody as like, as if this is casting for some kind of television show. And he sees the generals as an important part of his cabinet. And I think they have outsized influence with him because of their resumes and what they have accomplished in their military careers. And I think they will be very influential on him in terms of any potential use of military force. And I trust them and their breadth and depth of knowledge. And I think they are key to keeping President Trump from doing things that could be very, very dangerous for our country and for the world.
If this is true, what should the country, what should the Congress, what should national leadership be doing right now, Senator, about this president who may, in fact, be threatening us with World War III?
Well, I think what we need to be doing is the oversight that Congress must do. And it's something that, with my background as a prosecutor and auditor, I've spent probably more time on oversight in my career than, frankly, trying to pass new laws. And I think that oversight job is incredibly important right now, that my Republican colleagues that chair all these committees, that they ask the tough questions about what the president is and isn't doing, that we keep some kind of accountability between the legislative branch and the executive branch. We can't change what he says, but we certainly can weigh in terms of how he is doing his job, and we can certainly weigh in with appropriations decisions in terms of what is funded and what isn't. But there is this check and balance, but he still has, obviously, a tremendous amount of power, particularly in terms of foreign policy.
Senator Claire McCaskill is my guest. Senator, I just have you for a few more minutes. I wanted to ask you about a couple of issues. Let's turn to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. The other day, you said that Republicans were, and I'm quoting here, were trying to sabotage the markets. What did you mean by that, and what needs to be done to address it?
Well, you know, the problem we have with the individual markets is the idea was it would be a place where people could come and buy insurance if they don't get insurance at work. Keep in mind, the vast majority of Missourians that have insurance still receive that insurance through the workplace. And then another big chunk of Missourians get insurance on the marketplace with subsidies. A very small percentage of Missourians are buying their insurance on the marketplace without subsidies. People who make more than $75,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, they are struggling because it's gotten so expensive on the exchanges. And why has it gotten so expensive? Because healthy people are not gravitating towards the exchanges. They now, with the mandate not being enforced, if you don't have healthy people in the insurance pool, guess who's left? The people who really need insurance who were sick. And guess what happened? It gets very, very expensive. So we have got to tackle this issue of how do we make these marketplaces stable. And what the president has done is he has undermined these marketplaces and the insurance companies who offer products on them by refusing to be certain with them about whether or not they're going to get their money.
Right.
They're owed certain monies under the plan, and he keeps going back and forth. And then even worse, he cut the budget by $100 million to advertise about the benefits of going on the exchange and actually buying insurance.
So realistically,
to cut down on the number of people who actually participate in the pool.
Given how intensely partisan and controversial this issue is it possible for Congress to weigh in and try to fix it, or is that simply a pipe dream right now?
I think I'm confident that's what the majority of Missourians want.
To
immediately go in and stabilize these markets, and we are close to a bipartisan deal to do that. If the president doesn't undermine it and come out against it, I think we will actually have something we can vote on within the next 30 to 60 days that will stabilize those individual markets. But the second thing they want us to do is get to work on costs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many things are blamed on Obamacare, but some of them have nothing to do with Obamacare, like high pharmaceutical costs, like the fact that we reward quantity, not quality, of medical care in this country, that we have not lined the incentives up in terms of, and people don't even know what they're paying for medical care. So we've got work to do on costs, but we, in the meantime, immediately, we need to get a bipartisan fix to the stability of these individual markets for those people who have no place else to buy insurance.
Where's your next town hall, Senator?
My next town hall is this afternoon in Washington, Missouri.
Okay.
Another county that went for Donald Trump, I think, by a 40-point margin. So I'll welcome all of the comers at Washington, Missouri, and try to answer as many questions as possible, and more importantly, learn what's on their minds. And it's been quite a journey. I've never done this many town halls, and I got to tell you, I'm a better senator because of it. I've learned a lot.
That's Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Senator, thanks. Always appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Bye.
When you go buy milk, you want it to be cheap, but dairy farmers need to be able to make ends meet too. That's why the federal government created a program in 2014 to help reconcile those interests. 3 years later, dairy farmers, lawmakers, even the Department of Agriculture says the Margin Protection Program, as it's called, leaves a whole lot to be desired. Joining us now to talk about this issue is Amy Mayer. She's a reporter based in Ames, Iowa, who covers agriculture for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. That's a reporting collaboration based here at KCUR. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Eric Neal's also with us. He's the owner of Neal & Sons Dairy in Cass County, Missouri. He's joined us from the farm before. And Eric, it's good to have you back as well. You there, Eric? We'll hope to get Eric here in just a minute. Okay. Amy, can you give us a quick rundown of what the Margin Protection Program is?
Sure. This is a safety net program that was based around some of the other programs that exist for crops. But the difference with dairy is that the variables have to be specific to this year-round constant supply program versus a crop where you have a harvest at a certain time of year. So the Margin Protection Program takes an average national cost for the three main ingredients in feed, which are soybean meal, corn, and alfalfa, and then it calculates the average national price for milk. And if in a given monthly or two-month period those two things are too close together, which would squeeze out the farmer's hope for a profit, if that gets too close together, then this program pays out to the farmers.
Eric, did you sign up for the Margin Protection Program?
Yes, I did, and I was very excited about it when it started. We signed up for the highest level to fit our farm operation.
Do you agree that the program as it's constituted right now isn't working as it should?
That I yes, it does not work. That is correct.
Because why, from your perspective, Eric?
So one of the things is the average price of alfalfa. I think it's around $100 to $110 a ton as far as MPP is concerned, the calculation. But dairy farms use premium alfalfa, which can be over $200 a ton. These are just kind of mathematical errors, I think. And the two-month part of it, there's a two-month average. That part doesn't really work well for dairy farmers either.
And the fact the program isn't working for you, Eric, what does this mean for your operation and your future as a dairy farmer?
So I really quickly learned not to buy the insurance that didn't work. And I was hoping that it wouldn't take until the next farm bill to work on it, and that's what's happening right now. We're trying to fix the complicated program that it is and the new thing that it is, and I think we're headed down the right path.
Amy Mayer, does everybody agree here that the program isn't working as it should?
Oh, well, I think it might be a little too sweeping to say everybody, but I can tell you that among the farmers I talked to who mostly were located in Northwest Iowa, they felt pretty consistently that it wasn't working. And as Eric was just saying, the main concern among people who would like to see the program work is that mathematical calculation. The National Federation of Milk Producers was a big advocate for the MPP, but then after it finally was written into law, they were really dissatisfied with the formula that it ended up using. So figuring out how to calculate something that will better reflect the economies actually on dairy farmers' farms is one of the main priorities for fixing or improving the program.
But Amy, why can't that happen in the meantime? Why can't we get that done before a new farm bill gets written?
There are very particular aspects of the farm bill that can be revisited during a farm bill, and then there are other pieces that can only be changed or modified through an act of Congress, which would be through the actual reauthorization of a farm bill. So I don't know what the particulars were with the MPP and what kinds of conversations may have been happening, but it does seem, as Eric suggested, that these changes aren't actually going to happen now until the rewriting of the farm bill,
Eric,
which is already getting started.
Right. Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas very much involved with that, I think. Eric, you've increased your herd from when you started 8 years ago. How many cows are you milking these days?
So we're trying to average 180 for the year. We made it to 185 this summer. We're down to 150 right now and having fall calves, so we'll be back up to 180 in a month or so.
Is that kind of fluctuation typical?
For my model, it is. We're a seasonal grazing dairy, so we have calves in the spring and the fall, not all year round.
All right. Amy, I'm wondering, why involve the government in the dairy industry in the first place? Because some people say it has no business being there.
Well, I hope you'll put this question to Eric also, but what I can tell you historically is that since the Great Depression, there has been some effort to ensure that a milk supply would be constant and affordable, and over the years, the government has changed how they go about that, but I think fundamentally there is the double desire of, one, making sure that dairy farmers stay in business, because, two, they want to have milk be always available and generally affordable everywhere in the country year round.
So, Eric, this sounds like it's a really good thing. Is it or not?
It is. You know, it's not perfect. It's not perfect for everybody, but we have to remember that it's insurance. It's not a subsidy. The premium for that insurance, the price that farmers pay for the privilege of having the insurance, is subsidized, but not the milk that we produce. So we have to pick what works for our farm. I did a quick calculation before we talked, and so the maximum, I believe, is 5 million pounds of milk that you can insure with the new MPP proposed change. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right, Amy?
I haven't done that now, so I'll take your word for it.
Okay, so I believe that's right. So it gives smaller farms a chance to avert some risk. So if you figure that times the 41,000 of us that produce the milk in the United States, that's all that we have, that's about 24.5 million gallons of milk, which sounds like a lot,
mm-hmm.
but there's also a lot of us. And so that's kind of insurance that the milk will be there and it'll be a reasonable price. And that's what these programs are about, affordable food.
So, Eric, if we got rid of this insurance program, what would happen? What would be the impact?
So there is a country that's done that, and that's New Zealand. I think in 1984, they just stopped all farm subsidies, period. And it was calamitous, I believe. But they worked through it, and that worked for New Zealand, a small island with a very temperate climate. I don't know that that would work here. Mr. Market always decides what the price is of a commodity, no matter what we do to it. We can wiggle around and subsidize and do all those things, but Mr. Market still ends up deciding. I think that would be a catastrophic thing. I do.
Amy, do you agree with that?
I think it is. I do think some kind of program is necessary in the milk industry. I think the dairy industry. I think Eric made a really good point when he said that this is insurance. This is not just a subsidy. So it's not a matter of farmers not taking part in the risk. They are very much taking part of the risk. This is just to really to help mitigate a catastrophic loss, mm-hmm. either due to exorbitant feed prices or a sudden drop in demand for whatever reason. So I think it's unlikely and also just politically unrealistic to think that all the farm subsidies, all the farm support programs would go away. And I do think it's important to notice, to recognize also that with dairy, you're talking about something that is produced in all 50 states, and the cost of doing business is very different in those different locations. So you also have some geographic considerations that I think the MPP could do a better job of addressing.
Eric, have you ever had to file a claim or received a payout via this program?
We did. Yes, in 2015, I believe we did.
Can I ask for how much was it for?
So I think there were two, and the first one we couldn't buy a cup of Starbucks coffee with.
So what was the point of that then?
It was just the math. That's just how it worked. So this is the difference between what we expected to get as a margin and what the program said. So if we produced 10,000 pounds of milk and there was a penny difference, that's 10,000 is 100. Let's see, is it 1,000 hundreds of milk? So 1,000 pennies. It's not much.
Yeah.
Even at 50 cents, it's not 50 cents on 100,000 pounds of milk is like $1,000 a month. It's not a huge payout here. It's just insurance to help us get through a bad time, like a drought, or if we decide not to sell to other countries.
Amy, just a final point here. One thing I found interesting from your piece on all this was that we have far fewer farmers, but far more cows than we did 20 years ago. Why is that?
Every time there is a cycle in the dairy industry that involves prices going low or farmers losing profit, you have some farms that go out of business. One common way they go out of business is by selling their herd to a larger farmer. So that's one common way that farms grow. The other thing is there's a lot more advanced technology now. There's even robotics in dairy farms and other things that can make can reduce the daily labor input that is required, but those technologies are expensive, and if you're going to deploy them, you need to have economies of scale, so a larger herd in order to justify the investment that you're making. So you see dairies with more cows but fewer dairies.
You can find Amy's piece on the Margin Protection Program at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's headlined, As Lawmakers Rewrite Policy, Dairy Farmers Push for Change. Amy, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Eric Neal is the owner of Neal & Sons Dairy in Cass County. Eric, always appreciate you taking time with us.
You bet. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll switch topics. We'll turn to LGBTQ youth living in small towns and what that experience is like. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On the program yesterday, we learned about a Kansas City group helping millions of people access clean water. We also asked a tourism official and an astrophysicist, did August eclipse live up to the hype? You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, the big read is getting Kansas City on the same page again, this time with Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried. Also, we'll find out how board games can help us get along a little better. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's tough enough being young and gay or transgender in this country, but what if you're young and gay or transgender in a small Midwestern town? Well, the surprise finding from a KU researcher is it may not be as bad as you might think. With us here to talk about that is the KU researcher. That's Megan Paisley. She's an assistant professor in the School of Social Welfare at the University of Kansas. Megan, nice to have you.
Hi, nice to be here.
Also with us is Hayden Lee Shankles Longenilia. She's 23, who identifies as gender queer trans woman. Hayden grew up in a small town near Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and Hayden joins us now by Skype. Hayden, thanks for taking some time.
Absolutely, I'm proud to be on.
Megan, what did you set out to do here?
I really wanted to understand the experiences of LGBTQ youth in small towns, just to get to know them a little bit better and figure out primarily what can communities do to be more supportive. There's not a lot of research around LGBTQ youth in small towns. There's a little bit, but a lot of it comes from sort of a deficit perspective in terms of thinking about what's wrong with small towns, what's bad about them. And I wanted to kind of look at them from a different perspective in terms of, you know, there may be challenges, but what can they also bring to LGBT youth?
But when you went into it, were you thinking there probably are a whole lot of problems associated with being trans or gay in a small town?
Sure. That's what the research says, that the small towns are more hostile, that there's more victimization. And some of that is true. But there's also positive aspects of living in small towns that the research shows.
Well, let's talk about that. What did you find out in your studies of both trans and LGBTQ youth in small towns?
Sure. One of the most interesting findings for me was that the size of the community had little to do with the youth's well-being. It was really about the climate of the community. And so the number of people in the town didn't really matter. It was how youth perceived people treated them. And so if a town was small, but there were supportive people in the town, youth had good well-being outcomes. They weren't as it wasn't as bad as we think that it might be. So it really was more about how people treat them as opposed to the number of people in the town.
So it goes without saying then that the climate in one town might be very different than in another town. There's a lot of variation out there.
Absolutely. And one thing I did find in my study was that youth in small towns did face more victimization, but so did youth in towns that were more hostile. And so not every small town was inherently hostile to LGBTQ youth, but that tends to be the narrative that we hear and that we think about around this population.
Hayden, I'm wondering, what do you make of all this? Does it ring true to you based on your own experiences?
Overall, yes. My personal experience wasn't the best out of all the stories out there, but I know a lot of queer people that grew up in small towns, and it varies tremendously what all of our experiences were like. Like Megan said, it's really dependent upon what kind of resources we have available to us and what our community is like. Growing up in a small town isn't bad in itself, because I personally love small town living, but it's just, it's hard to get resources out there, and that's the main thing that I think we need to focus on and fix.
Hayden, if I understand correctly, your situation may have been complicated because you moved at least a couple times, I think, and that couldn't have been easy.
No, it's not easy for any teenager to swap towns like that, but it's definitely not easy when you're queer and you already don't have a big queer base in your life. Like, you don't know a lot of queer people. And when you move, you're always the odd one out automatically. And then coming out as queer just makes it a little bit worse. But
how did you go about navigating finding a supportive community when you did move? How did you, and how old were you at the time?
My first big move was when I was 14. And at that point in time, I wasn't really super out about who I was. It wasn't until I was about 16 that I finally started being more vocal about who I was, and that's when I started looking for a community that was more similar to who I am. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was honestly online, because that's just how everyone finds everything nowadays.
I was going to say, how did you find it? And what can you find out about a community online? Can you get some pretty good dope on a town in terms of how comfortable you might be in a place that you've never been to before?
Definitely. Queer people are very loud. That's something we're good at being. we spent a lot of long, you know, a long time being quiet, and now that we finally found a voice, it's really easy to find groups of queer people in other towns, and they are extremely helpful in telling you what experiences are like and providing resources and telling you where these organizations are that can be, you know, a good help for you. And the communities are extremely helpful in making sure that that information is out there and it's easily accessed.
I mean, the school system was a big issue for you, Hayden, and I'm wondering why, and what was your experience there when you moved, I think, when you were in your mid-teens?
The biggest issue with my school was that they were unwilling or unable to accept that it was important to have resources for queer youth. It wasn't very common for people to be out there. In my 4 years at the high school I went to, well, a little under 4 years, I was probably one of three or four people that were out the entire time.
Wow, wow.
And so because of that, the school faculty didn't really see it as, you know, something important. But just because we weren't out doesn't mean that we weren't there, because we were. After high school and after graduations, I've found so many people that I went to school with that are queer and that have identified as queer for a long time. They just weren't out about it because they didn't think that it would mean anything. They didn't think that, you know, they would have the support that they needed.
Well, what was that journey like for you, being one of just four kids in a high school, I gather you're saying, trying to navigate those difficult years as just one of four kids in their own group?
It was intimidating and scary at first, but as I got older and as I immersed myself into more of a greater and broader queer community, and as I started going to LGBT resource centers, I kind of took it as like a personal mission to be extremely out and proud and to fight and to argue. And I wanted to get those resources in my school, and I tried for years. And it's just being out and being one of the few that's out, I feel like it's my responsibility to have the voice for those who can't be.
Right, right.
And that's something I still try to do today.
Let me go back to Megan Paisley here, again, assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at KU. You know, not to make excuses here, but it may be asking a lot of a small town to build a support for kids who are different in one way or another. When you're in such a small town and budgets are strapped, and that's a difficult situation inherently, isn't it?
Sure. And one of the things that I talk about in my research is that not every town can support an LGBTQ community center. It's just not feasible. A town maybe the size of Lawrence can, something like that, but these smaller towns, it's just not feasible. But there are things that social workers and educators and just concerned community members can do.
Like what? I'm curious.
Yeah, like things like starting a LGBT group at an open and affirming church. So one of the things that the youth talked about in my study was that having open and affirming churches that were supportive of LGBTQ people went so far for helping them feel supported in their community. And so providing a program one night a week where LGBTQ youth can come, get together, maybe throw in some money and order some pizza.
And relax a little
just
bit.
Just be around people that are like them. That can be started in the school. It can be started at a, like I said, an open and affirming church or any other supportive place in the town, a mental health center, something like that. Those are low cost, sometimes free things that can be done that really go a long way to providing support for these youth.
When you talk to schools, when you talk to small town chamber of commerce people, are they open to trying to help, you know, kids navigate that and find that sweet spot, that place where they can be themselves and relax a little bit?
You know, like you said, it sort of depends on the town and it sort of depends on who you're talking to. One place that I found to be really supportive and open were libraries. Libraries tend to be, you know, the whole access to information, having people having available resources, things like that. And so that's another place. And there's often libraries in small towns, even if they're tiny. And so that could be another place that youth are going and finding support.
Hayden, did libraries or churches offer you any a place where you could go and chill in your own experience?
Not in my specific small town, but in nearby communities, yes.
Yeah. What would you have changed at school if you could have, Hayden?
The number one thing that I would have changed is I really would have liked to have a GSA there. And that's something.
And what is a GSA?
It's a gay straight alliance, even though I think the terminology is a little outdated now because saying gay isn't very inclusive.
Right.
It gets the basic point across.
But it's getting straight kids and gay kids together, right?
In a sense, yes. It's just a safe space within a school. It's just like any other kind of like club function where there's a teacher sponsor and you just get together and you do things together and you can do... I mean, it doesn't cost the school any money,
I was gonna
honestly,
say it's cheap,
because
right?
it's the
yeah.
teacher's voluntary time, it's students, and it's the teacher and the students that put the money together to do anything special if they want to. It's just the fact that it provides that safe space where you know you can go and you can talk and you can be who you want to be, and you don't have to be afraid about it. And that's just something that I think would have helped my school tremendously, is having that safe space.
Megan, it's pretty hard to imagine that a school would argue against something like that.
It happens, though, and sometimes you'll get, you know, parents or other community members that are anti having a GSA in the school, and sometimes that influences whether there is one or not. But they have been growing a lot over the last decade or so, and lots of schools do have them.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about LGBTQ youth living in small Midwestern towns, what that's like. If you want to join our conversation with a question or maybe something out of your own life that might be relevant here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Megan, I can't help but wonder what you might have found a decade ago or even 20 years ago had you done the same study. I mean, the results almost certainly would have been very different.
I think so. I think, first of all, it probably would have been hard to get the number of youth that I got to speak out and take the survey or to interview with me. I know I had 34 youth in small towns that talked with me, and I think it would have been a lot harder to get them to talk to me.
How did you find them?
A decade or two ago.
Yeah.
A lot of it was through social media. So I advertised in some of the traditional ways that we do research, posting flyers at libraries and, you know, things like that. But the biggest way was really advertisements on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and getting youth that way. And then I would go to them, to wherever they lived. Sometimes we would meet at coffee shops or libraries, sometimes at their house, depending on if they were comfortable, and just interview them there.
Do you want to say what state you focused on?
I don't, for confidentiality reasons, but it was a Midwestern state.
Yeah. And when you met with these kids, I mean, you got 46?
34.
34. Is that enough kids to draw many conclusions from?
For a qualitative study doing interviews, 34 was pretty good. I also had over 300 take a survey across the entire state that I was doing the research in. So I had some numerical data that had a large number, and then 34 to do interviews with.
Oh, why did you want to focus on a Midwestern state?
A lot of the research that's been done tends to be in bigger cities, so that was part of the reason why I looked at the small towns. But then there's also a lot of coastal. You see a lot of East Coast and West Coast, some Chicago. But I just really wanted to focus on what's going on in the middle of the country, right? Like these youth that, in the flyover states where there's just not a lot of information out there on the in terms of research.
The fact that you found that, you know, there's always exceptions, but in general, things may not be as bad as the stereotype might suggest. What kind of response have you gotten to what you came up with here?
I think the important thing for me is that we're seeing communities as not just inherently bad, right? And so coming from a social work perspective, which is where I'm situated in, you know, we think about the strengths of people and our clients. And so I think we also need to think about the strengths of communities. And so if we approach communities from a strengths perspective and say, yeah, there's things that are going on, that these kids are victimized more in small towns. These small towns do tend to be more hostile, but they're not 100% bad. And so there's these good things, these open and affirming churches, these GSAs in the schools that can really bring support. If we go to communities from a supportive lens instead of a everything is bad lens, they're going to be a lot more willing to open up and to do things, right? If I'm told you're bad, it's going to be hard for me to want to change. Whereas if I'm told, hey, there's some things we need to fix, but you have a lot of strengths, then I'm going to be much more likely to try to change those bad things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Your own experience coming back to you here as we talk about this, Hayden, what was your best experience in terms of finding support in the small town where you are? And what was your worst experience, maybe your loneliest, darkest moment?
I guess the biggest support that I found in my own small community was with, honestly, it was with the school in itself, but it's also where I found the darkest moment. There were a handful of teachers there that, you know, they were watching me and they were seeing the struggles I was going through, and they would take the effort to approach me, and, you know, they would offer their classrooms as a safe space for me, and they would talk to me, and they would counsel me, and they would make sure that I was okay, and they told me that no matter what I was doing was brave, and that they were here for me. And at the same time,
I mean, that must have been a remarkable experience for you, Hayden. I mean, as you look back on it now.
It was. It's to people like those, teachers like those, that really helped me get through things that I honestly didn't think I would get past. And they helped shape me into who I am today. And at the same time, though, that same school had the same people that tore me down the most. There were a lot of faculty members who honestly said the opposite. They said they wished that I would be more quiet and that I wouldn't try to disturb the peace, basically, because they were happy with how things were. But being complacent in any form of oppression is, you know, that's not peace. And so
what were they, can you recall what they were objecting to more specifically? What was it that you were saying that they had problems with?
Basically, just I was flat out telling people that denying basic rights for these queer youth was inherently homophobic and transphobic, and that it needed to be addressed because I didn't see an issue with trying to provide a safe space for all of your students. Why did you only have to specifically focus on the majority? Why couldn't you provide that the same resources for everybody else? And that wasn't something that they were fond of hearing. They didn't like being called out for being intolerant, and they didn't like being called out about differences. And it's just something that I think some small towns have a hard time accepting, is that things are becoming okay, and it's not like how it used to be.
I'm guessing the pooch sitting on your lap there, it sounds like, agrees with you here. Do I have that right, Hayden?
Yeah, my puppy's not a... very happy that I'm ignoring him right now.
Yeah, I'm getting that sense, but that's just fine. Megan, do you have any sense, even anecdotally, about small towns, you know, intentionally becoming more welcoming to kids at different points, different places on the gender spectrum? Are you seeing signs of that out there?
I think so. I mean, just the fact that there are libraries, there are churches that are willing to open their doors and be a safe place for LGBTQ youth in these small towns, I think is a sign that we wouldn't have seen a decade or two ago, that things are progressively changing. I also think that the more we talk about these issues, the more it's in the public, sometimes the more backlash there is. And so you think about the conversations around trans people in bathrooms and how important that conversation is to have, and making sure that we have gender-neutral bathrooms or safe spaces for trans folks to go to the bathroom.
Right.
But also the more that it's talked about, the more danger I've heard trans folks talk about how they feel like they're in, because it's more public now. And so with progress also comes backlash, and so we have to be aware of that too.
Cindy from Kansas City, Missouri asked this: what can us middle-aged LGBT folk who came out ages ago do to help those in rural areas come out? Hayden, let me go to you first with that.
My first thing would just to be supportive and to be available. That was one of the things that I really loved the most when I first went to a LGBT like community center. I got to see older queer people, and I got to see that, you know, it gets better. You grow up and you actually get to become an adult, and you get to love who you are, and you get to be with the people that you love, and they share all these stories, and you're like, oh my God, those are just like mine. And here I am thinking that I'm not going to make it through, but I have living actual proof in front of me that you can. And that really made it a lot easier for me to lift myself up and to be who I was and to be out and to be proud and to start doing community organizing and to start speaking out. It's seeing those people and getting that little glimmer of hope that's really going to make a difference.
Megan, what would you throw in here too?
Yeah, I would second what Hayden said, but I would also say partner with community organizations. Figure out maybe you're the one that's going to start that group that youth come to. It doesn't have to be somebody that's working at an organization or a church. It can be a community member that reaches out and says, this is important and we need to do this.
That's Megan Paisley from KU. Megan, thanks so much for coming over today. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Hayden Lee Shankles Longinelia. Hayden, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Coming up, Bill Brownlee and this week's Local Listen. Finally today, KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
Hello, I'm well.
Tell us about WIC and the Tricks.
Well, it's a nice transition because WIC and the Tricks is a Kansas City punk band with members that are gender nonconforming.
Okay.
And they have a record release party this Saturday at Davies, and they make quite a ruckus.
We're going to hear that right now. This is Tough as Nails from a new four-song release that's titled Not Enough. That's Tough as Nails from WIC and the Tricks. And Bill, we cover a whole lot of ground on this show, don't we?
We sure do.
We sure do. That's raw guitar, loose drums, snarled lyrics. I'm getting a very punky vibe from this song. What about WIC and the Tricks that catches your ear here?
You know, a lot of punk bands these days follow the rules. These guys are a little bit different, not just because of their sexual identities, but to me, they sound a lot, even though they're considered a punk band, they sound a lot like the 70s glam rock band Kiss.
I was going to say, you hear a little Kiss in here, don't you?
Right. I hear Rock and Roll All Night.
Yeah.
I hear Detroit Rock City. And you know, that's refreshing because not many quote-unquote punk bands are willing to go that direction.
You know, Tough as Nails is from a four-song release called Not Enough. Is this thing, you recommend the whole thing? Is it worth a listen?
If you like what you're hearing now, the other three songs are just as angry, just as mean, and a couple of them are fairly profane as well.
Any sense of what their overall message is? What are they saying to us?
They're saying, just like your previous guests were saying, people should be themselves and embrace whoever they are. There's a little bit of class consciousness going on with a few of their songs in addition to that.
Davies Uptown Ramblers Club is where folks can catch WIC and the Tricks this weekend. Tell us a little bit about that show, Bill.
Yeah, it's a full night of punk rock. There are bands on the bill, including the Quivers. Davies is, you know, one of the great long-standing rock clubs in town. There's cold beer. There's a bit of grittiness to the venue. It's two rooms. It's, you know, for guys like me who have been around for a few decades, it's a place where I have so many memories year after year.
And just for the record, Tough as Nails, what you hear about WIC and the Tricks is that their shows are lasciviously energetic performances. There's a group worth seeing live, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay, that's Bill Brownlee talking about WIC and the Tricks. Bill, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's program, how author Tim O'Brien is helping get Kansas City readers on the same page, and we'll learn how board games could be the key to better family communication this fall and winter, and who can argue with that? Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produce this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. We'll be right back.